You are listening to Screenfish Radio. I'm your host, Steve Norton. A young executive has her life changed when she's called to a remote small town at the Christmas season and falls in love with a mysterious stranger. An attractive wannabe baker has her life changed when she runs into an ex before the big baking competition. Nope, that's not it either. A reporter has her life changed when she meets a prince. The Hallmark Christmas movie has become a genre unto themselves. Featuring cookie-cutter storylines and generic plot twists, the films have grown in popularity in the last few years, yet are not without controversy as well. This week on the show, Screenfisher Heather Johnson and newcomer Christine Embry join us to look at the appeal of these similarly dissimilar films, how their characters stand up in the 21st century world, and what they say about the Christmas season. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Conversation was helpful. I appreciated that. Your insight was really good. I'm glad that you guys were willing to do that.
I had a lot of fun. Yep. You know, whenever anybody would say to me, "You're watching something again," I'd be like, "It's because I'm doing this thing. I have to."
To be
you
fair,
just have to subject yourself.
Yeah, to be fair, 20 of them is not what we required, but
nobody else knows that. And to be fair, I probably stopped 5 of those halfway through because. You know, they didn't meet my criteria.
Welcome to Screenfish Radio. We're glad you could join us this week as we tackle not one, not two, but at least 10 Hallmark Christmas movies in our special Christmas episode. This week, rather than tackle one film, we decided to tackle several and try to get to the heart of the Hallmark quote-unquote genre, subgenre style of Christmas film. And this week I'm so thrilled to have with us Screenfisher Heather Johnson and newcomer Christina Embry. Welcome, ladies.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm so glad you could join us because Hallmark Christmas movies are a thing unto themselves. We have heard about them online. They play 24 hours a day this time of year on the Hallmark Channel or on W Network here in Canada. Even Saturday Night Live is showing parodies of these types of films on their show. And of course, they are known for their, no pun intended, cookie-cutter storylines that often involve a female protagonist who is looking for something in her life until she stumbles across a mysterious stranger who may or may not be from her past, where she discovers the true meaning of Christmas through the events that ensue out of their relationship. They are ridiculous, they are charming, they are good, they are bad, and we thought that this year it might be interesting for us to really try to get to the heart of these films, look at their pros and their cons, and try to discover, if you will, what it is about these films that's so appealing to their audience. Once again, as always, this episode is rated S for spoilers, although I have a feeling you won't really need to know that on this particular podcast. But anyway, let's get right into it. Ladies, what do you think? What are your impressions of Hallmark Christmas movies?
Wow. Well, I think I got invited to be a part of this group because I was going to blow that goal out of the water, which I did. So I think I watched around 20.
Holy crap. Are you serious?
And so I think, you know, yeah, I'm coming with a little bit more than 10 in my pocket. And a lot of those, I am not ashamed to say, were rewatches or re-rewatches. Actually, there's one that we watch every single year since it was made. So I think I definitely bring that. If anything, I bring the passion and the ridiculous excitement over these Hallmark-style Christmas movies. So I'm like the pro side, and I think it brings all the Christmas joy and everything. And I'm willing to overlook, at times, some seriously bad acting in order to get, you know, a couple good vibes.
Heather, what about you?
Whereas Yeah, whereas I'm more coming at it as I have never been super interested in these types of movies. Maybe there's been a few here and there, but for the most part, I was more of like, hey, here's an excuse to just binge watch a lot of movies that I don't have to think about very seriously, and I can just kind of absorb as able. I think I'm coming between 8 and 10, I guess 9 after watching one, you know, even last night, pulling this off last minute. And kind of, you know, yeah, hit the Hallmark, hit the Netflix, hit the kind of obscure ones. And I'm good. I think I'm set for the next 5 years on most of them. There were a couple that were very enjoyable that I actually will probably rewatch. But for the most part, I think I'll stick to, like, The Grinch and Prancer and Rudolph.
Okay, so I came in at 11. I came in around 11. Woo-hoo! Between the, yeah. Here's a little backstory that I have never admitted on the podcast before. And, you know, when you try and get street cred in the podcast industry about film, this probably isn't the thing you want to admit. But I was raised on soap operas. I remember very, very fondly in my teen years and even younger watching soap operas. That's just what I did with my mom. You know, if I was home at lunch hour or during the summers, that was, you know, that was what we watched. All My Children for the win.
I grew up watching them as well. So you're not alone in that. With my grandmother every summer.
I did not grow up watching.
I knew all the Guiding Light and like the whole series of Guiding Light and As the World Turns.
Oh, yeah. See, no, we were stuck mostly on the ABC soap opera universe, if you will. So pretty much anything there.
I did not watch soap operas, and I actually find them rather annoying. I often compare, and all you Downton Abbey fans can get mad at me, but I compare Downton Abbey to, like, it's a soap opera. It's just set in a different time period. So it's interesting, because I would not have connected soap operas with Hallmark Christmas movies.
I'm stunned that you didn't if you've watched 20 of these things, because they are Christmas soap operas. But anyway, that's... And, yeah, you know, I think, was it Christina that said you're willing to forgive bad acting because of them? Because there's a lot to forgive.
Good practice, forgiveness.
I guess that's true. I don't know if that is what you know, scripture calls for, forgiving Hallmark Christmas movies, but... okay, so, I mean, let's talk about the films in general. We've each seen, Christina's seen twice than both of us.
We have our core. I mean, we picked those core movies that we all watched.
We did. Now, the interesting thing about the core ones we picked is they mostly were from Netflix, or at least on other streaming services. So, I mean, let's talk about, what are the things you noticed about the films initially? Like, what was your first impulses, first reactions?
It couldn't just be a soap opera set during Christmas time. It couldn't just happen at Christmas. Like, Christmas had to be a integral part of the story. Like, without Christmas, the story couldn't have happened. That made a good one. If it was just a soap opera that happened at Christmas time, I would have said, that's a bad one.
Okay, that's interesting. But, like, did you find that there were ones where it didn't need to happen at Christmas? Because I found that was pretty central to most of them.
Oh, yeah, there were a ton. There was this one about building a float for the Rose Parade. I can't remember which channel that was on. I'm pretty sure that was a Hallmark one. It was so bad that halfway through we just turned it off because there was absolutely no spark between the two main characters. And all it was about them. And it just coincidentally happened in December. And it was just not, it wasn't about Christmas. It has to be about Christmas to really be a Hallmark Christmas movie.
Interesting. I never considered that aspect about it before, because they all happen at Christmas. But there are...
Right, but there's some where, like, without Christmas, it couldn't happen.
Right.
Like they're coming back to a place to visit family at Christmas. Or my personal favorite that we watched, 12 Dates of Christmas, was all about the 12, like, about Christmas Day and about the song, The 12 Days of Christmas. And it couldn't happen any other time of year. It was about her going to Christmas parties and giving a Christmas gift and all the magic of Christmas. Whereas the other ones, there are other ones that could just happen anywhere at any time. It just happened to be like, well, let's make it in December and throw Christmas in there.
Hmm. Heather, what about you?
For one, I'll second that. You know, the idea that it, the Christmas part of it can't be a you know, icing, so to speak, or just like decoration. It has to be, you know, the kind of the feeling and the emotion when you are really kind of embracing what Christmas is and what it means. I mean, you can throw in the, well, Christmas is about family and Christmas is about love. But if there's no demonstration as to why those themes of Christmas are important in the movie, then, you know, it falls a little bit flat. But I think one, the ones that tended to be the most kind of entertaining, at least for me, is I'm not as willing to overlook bad acting. And I don't know if that's because of like years and years of having these conversations like Steve and with Screenfish and stuff. If it is awkward, I'm totally zoned out. Like, I'm just like, this is dumb. I don't feel like watching this. I have to. But if that's, you know, not that it has to be, you know, Oscar worthy, but it has to be believable in the sense of that the actors and the actresses are invested in these characters and they're pulling it off. And I think, you know, something can kind of be like cheesy and corny and sappy, but have good acting and it be redeemable. But for me, if it's, you know, if they're like literally kind of just cardboard kind of feeling, or just feels so forced, and I'm like, I don't really believe that this person lines up to this character, then I'm checked out. So I think it needs to have a certain level of acting prowess for the whole concept of this kind of like cheesiness to be pulled off.
I hear what you're saying. To me, it's not about the quality of the acting. Again, growing up on soap operas, I mean, you can say whether or not this is soap operas or not. They're shot almost identical to soap operas in every single way, including down to the lighting. Further side note to that story, I actually did my senior thesis on soap operas when I was in university, but that's another story. Looking back,
I'm going to hunt that down in the archives of the internet.
Because, it's not online.
And I'm going to post it for all to see.
It's not
just
online.
So you know, unless you bribe me otherwise.
You know what?
And then you need to do a relative study to show us how Christmas movies are, in fact, mini soap operas.
Oh, I believe me, I could. But, you know, to me, it's interesting. It wasn't about the quality of the acting, because I didn't think the quality of the acting was good in any of them.
Really?
However,
none
I did
of them?
None of them. Not one. But there's a level of charisma that the character has to have. And I think that's why they take all these 90s stars, because it's almost like, I mean, it's not just branding. You already have a connection to them. I don't want to throw shade at Candace Cameron Bure.
There's a nostalgic, like a nostalgic element to it, to where we're already bought in because we know who these people are.
Yeah. Like, I'm not throwing shade on Candace Cameron Bure. Apparently apparently both she and Lacey Chabert are tied for the most Hallmark Christmas movies. They've both done 8. But, I mean, their characters, their dialogue, it's wooden. Like, you know, it's not like they're given any great drama to work with. But there's a certain level of charisma there than in other ones I filmed. Like, I liked the Candace Cameron Bure ones more than other ones. I actually liked Christmas Town or Christmas Under Wraps. And, you know, they're poor quality, but they're more engaging. And, like, there are some of these ones I saw that couldn't take place any other time than Christmas. I watched one, Charming Christmas. I could barely get through it. But I realized I just didn't care about the characters. And it was almost right. The same plot I'd seen in other movies. But there's a charisma to the characters, to the actors, that help beat it out to me than other ones.
And I think what you just said right there, Steve, about like the same plot over and over again, because you see it like all over social media and the memes of, you know, raise your hand if you watch the same blonde actress, you know, across multiple channels, have the same plot with like the same mountain man, or the businesswoman leaves for the small town, or, you know, they don't like each other. That plot is kind of regurgitated over and over, but in some cases it's enough to keep your attention, and in other cases it falls flat, and it's kind of like determining why and how. And I think even just listening to the three of us, we've got kind of different standards as to what kept us engaged versus when we checked out.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's fair. So, I mean, Heather, since you've said that, let's talk about the women in these films. What do you notice about the women and their motivations in these films?
Oh, sorry. What I was doing in my head was kind of comparing the different films as to when, like, the woman went somewhere versus when someone came to her. So I think there's, you know, that kind of it impacts motivation and kind of how the whole story went. And I think some of my favorites are when somebody came into her world and then how she navigated her existing world with the, you know, the surprise or the challenge or just the element of unexpectedness, which what she was waiting for in living out her life and how that was disrupted by the arrival of said man. So I think that's an important differentiator for me. You know, the ones where she's like going off somewhere or going to seek it out actually weren't as engaging to me as the ones where something was being brought to her. And I think what in that case, and or I guess in all cases, is where depending on the challenge, is it challenging her notion of love, her notion of success, her expectation? And so I don't know if it's so much of a particular characteristic as it is a response to how her worldview is being changed. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it makes total sense. That was a common thread. There was some sort of demand that the core of who she is at the beginning has to change by the end. That was a recurring theme in some ways. You know, if she is working in the business world, she's being told to slow down. You know, you're going to miss out on life. Or that was a key.
I think it had for me. I hear what you're saying. I was going to go more with the idea of identity, where they were really coming to grips with who am I, and the idea of slowing down. But it was slowing down in order to say, I've just been going at it. I've had my head down. I've been working hard. I've been doing all the things. And then, like, all of a sudden something shakes them where they go, is this really who I want to be? Is this really who I am? And they are forced to wrestle through that. And in doing so, they end up dealing with a lot of other issues because there is always a parent who has died, or a best friend who has moved away, or, you know, some other thing that has to get healed and dealt with. And so for me, it's more of an identity thing. And I can totally be reading into that as a person who is coming up on their midlife and saying, who am I? But I really do think that there's a lot of identity stuff in there that women connect to because they're looking for that. Who am I? Am I mom? Am I wife? Am I this business person? Am I a best friend? Who the heck am I at this stage of my life? And so even though there's a romantic side to the story, it's really about a woman wrestling through that identity. Who am I? And deciding who that is and then pursuing it.
Yeah, see, that now that's interesting. Now, again, I'm the only man in the group here, but certainly identity is key. I didn't have the death of a best friend or a family member at all in any of the ones I watched. It felt like the woman I saw were always burned by a man before, or they were too focused on their work, or at least that's what I saw. Now, I'm not saying
you didn't have any with, like, it was just the mother and the father has died, or just the father and the mother has died. Like, that is, like, that's kind of a staple.
Well, yeah, especially, I mean, if you watch Night Before Christmas, she had lost her parents. If you watch,
but she's not dealing with it.
She was going.
She's not grappling with it.
There is. There's kind of. She's decorating for the first time, or she's pulling out the old ornaments.
I suppose that's true.
That's
a.
And so it was more subtle, but it's still there. But something that just kind of what Christina just said, and kind of maybe, you know, when we look at the formula and his people, I really feel like this is all a repeat of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Like, if you think about it, it's this whole something about the past, something in the present impacts my past that is going to direct my future, and it's going to be, and I have to deal with these different layers, and at the end of this movie, every single person is different. Right. You know, whether they watched it, whether they experienced it, whether it was the main character. So really, they're all just, you know, structured around Charles Dickens. There you go. Merry Christmas. I figured it out.
And I actually think it's less about, and maybe this is because I'm a woman, but it's less about the man that burned them, for the most part. For the most part, that's just like, as the movie goes on, you find out, like, those were just casualties of a person, of themselves. Like, they weren't ready because they hadn't healed from these certain things. And I'm thinking about, you brought up Night Before Christmas, but I'm thinking about Dear Santa. She has these parents who are super rich and they never spend any time with her. And so she's dying inside. And the true thing she's looking for is friendship and his relationship, and she tries to fill it up with things. And then, you know, there's just all in all of them, there's always these like, no, Spirit of Christmas. I mean, she literally, the reason she gets sent to the house is because her boss tells her, we know you don't have any plans for Christmas because you have no family. And so like, those are the real issues that they're dealing with and working through. And I can't think of one that doesn't have that kind of a storyline in the background. It's less about the man that burned them and more about the person they are.
Okay, that's fair. Certainly every one of them has a hole in their heart. A Christmas-shaped hole, to paraphrase. But that's interesting because I found that the deaths were almost rarely mentioned in a lot of the ones I want. But that's interesting the way you're saying it because I hadn't thought of it that way. But a lot of the ones I watched, like I said, Charming Christmas really stuck out to me because I hated it so much. But, I mean, here's a woman who her only problem really is that she is focused in on her work. She's got both parents. Then the man who may or may not really be Santa stumbles into her life and shows her what it's like to live for others. And, you know, even her parents are like, you know what, they own the big store and they're trying to decide whether or not they're going to, you know, keep it or sell it and all this stuff. And, you know, at the last minute she decides not to. But so much of that is changed from just taking the focus off of herself in that case and learning to see for other people. And I mean, one of the key things that I saw in six of the movies, I saw there's some reference to them following her heart, or she needs to learn to follow her heart.
What does that mean?
Insulting. Okay, this is weird. As a man, listening to the way it's said to women, I thought it was insulting because you had all these women that were thinking with their head, and actually they say, one person actually said, you know what, it was probably Charming Christmas. I need to think less with my head and more with my heart. And I'm like, what in the heck does that mean? I got mad.
So, Steve, you're kind of not necessarily reading my mind, but something that, you know, I'm starting to think about is if you look at some of these themes, there's still a whole rescue complex going on. There's still a disruptor that makes the woman see something different and that she has to choose something different. And I don't know if that goes into identity, but there tends to be like an either or. You can either work or you can pursue family. You know, you can either go for those jobs or completely be willing to risk it all. Like there's a very almost, for me, at least what I was witnessing, a very strong dividing line of an either or, but it always involved, or at least majority of the time involved, a man coming in some way and disrupting it. So there's still this, oh, if he hadn't come into my life, I still would have like pushed forward with my career. Or if, you know, this widower and his child hadn't come into my life, you know, I would still be pursuing, you know, something else. So there's still this idea of the what shifts the main actress involves some sort of romance. And to me, it starts to make, as we talk about this, and I may be, you know, coming at it a little bit cynically, I don't know, but, you know, just a lot of this just kind of rolling my head, so it's not super articulate. But this idea of who is she and what is it about the disruptor or the man or the family that challenges that, and why in these movies is it so appealing? Because ultimately it's some guy coming in saying you need to do something different, whether it's direct or indirect or a result of something.
So then what is it about the men? Let's talk about that. What is it about? What are the overriding characteristics of the men in the films?
Well, this is what cracks me up about it, is because every single one of them are beta males masquerading as alpha males. And what I mean by that is they all have this persona of being this like tough guy, strong guy, you know, the dad that takes care of the kids without the wife, or the
one who owns the Christmas tree farm and keeps it going for the family business, never left the town, runs the store. There was one where literally the guy was like all these things, and he was like a third grade Sunday school teacher. I mean, like, everything on top. And then the reality is they're all just kind of like, tell me what to do and I'll do it. they're very much more the beta person once you get to know them. They back off. They don't come crashing in and force the woman to change her mind. They're just kind of waiting there in the distance with all their love and hugs and flannel. And I just think that that's so funny because I think it's the exact dichotomy of what I see happening in society. I watch it with my own girls where they're like, I want this big, strong male, but really I just want him to do everything I say or treat me the way I want to be treated or whatever. And so that's what I think. I think most of the men in the movie are beta males masquerading as alpha males. And the women are 100% the alphas in these movies, 100%.
I see it, especially as when you look about how the relationship progresses, how the man is impacted. So if you look at like Naughty and Nice with Hayley Duff, and you know, that was one where she's the super good love is, you know, psychoanalyst of her radio show in this tiny little Colorado town. And then this big shot LA DJ is stuck to work with her for a few weeks. And you start to see, you know, he gets her to lighten up a little bit, but mostly in that movie, it is her influence on him. And, you know, I'm wondering if that becomes somewhat over, you know, if I was overlooking that. But at the same time, I'm not, you know, I still kind of am aligned to it still took a man to disrupt her. Even if she influenced him, it's still this, you know, what are the other ways that her world could have been disrupted or influenced that didn't involve a guy? So maybe I'm like overthinking it now, but there's definitely, I agree that there's like this mutual influence, but I still wonder why it takes a guy.
I think there are some where the guy is the one who I would say disrupted isn't the word, because the male is never the protagonist. That's always focused on the female story. However, there are some that are more balanced. Snowed in Christmas.
Oh, I love that one.
That one was a little more balanced, and in some ways, where they both sort of had to change. The running gag in the house, because I've been watching these with my wife, is that when they always have that first awkward meeting, I always go, they're too different. They'll never get together. And but that one, I think, was the most even-keeled. But mostly, I think, I hear what you're saying, Christina, because there is sort of, you know, the stereotype of the men being more rugged in outward appearance, but just as wounded or just on the inside, you know, but again, a lot of times it's the man who is accused of thinking with his heart, and that's what the people that know him think of as the high redeeming quality. You know, so if it's in, you know, the rural atmosphere, he's the one that he helps take care of. He's usually a fix-it man or a handyman that doesn't, I don't know how they support the houses they actually own on their income. But they're always there to fix whatever, and they're sort of rough on the outside, but they're a single dad, or they're, you know, in one case was interesting, and this was which one was this? Christmas Town. He was a foster father, which I hadn't seen anything else. They started to deal with adoption as a theme in that one, but they hadn't done that in other ones. But I, Heather, at the same time, I agree with you completely that the man is usually the disruptor in some ways. But there's a quality to the man that has what the woman is missing. And I don't just mean the love aspect. They're usually more confident in who they are. And it's usually more settled on that, if that makes any sense. You know, like, whereas I said before, the woman character seems to have that Christmas-sized hole. The man seems to have sort of worked out that problem. And that's the quality that is so foreign to the female character.
And that, to me, goes back to that identity thing that I see going on, is that most of the men have become comfortable in their identity. And they've worked through whatever that, I didn't have to leave town because I can be here and be who I really am. And I don't have to, you know, hide in my work because I can be a good father and, you know, be a sensitive guy. And like they seem to be secure in their identity, whatever that happens to be, as ridiculous as it might be. But I don't see that in most of the female characters. They always are like shaky in their identity and asking that, like, who am I question as they go through the movie. And so sometimes I think that the male character is what helps them come back around to that question, because the male character always seems to be so secure even in who they are. I mean, and again, I'm going to go back to 12 Dates, my favorite one, which has Zach Morris in it. but he is very comfortable as a widower. Like, he can talk about his wife and not be uncomfortable in it. Of course, he also is like the coach for the hockey team for the boys in the orphanage, and somehow he manages to get paid enough money to like live an incredible life. But like, he is very secure in all of that, and he never seems flustered. He always seems to handle all of her flusterishness without any problems. And then like, she's always coming back to as you go through the 12 days with her, she keeps comparing herself to him. Like, how does he have it all together? How is he okay with all of this? I should be okay with all of this. And, yeah.
But then at the end of each film, she leaves what she has. See, this would be interesting, too. Heather, going back to what you were saying, it's one thing to say he's secure in what he has and that disrupts her way of life, because that could be anything, male or female or what have you. But she always ends up, like, ultimately, you would think if she figures out how to be confident in who she is, she would go home. But she doesn't. She throws it away.
Where's home?
This home is now him. You know, but it's like, that to me is problematic. Because how is that helping the identity? Doesn't she assume his as the man in the group? Correct me, ladies. Please. My lens is narrow.
I don't think we have enough information to assume all of that. Because in
it
some
turns
of them,
off exactly, and you're at the hour and a half, and
right,
you're left. It's left to your imagination.
I mean, for instance, Snowden Christmas. We don't actually know what ends up happening. Technically, they were both fighting for the same job, and she leaves the airport to go back to him. But what happens after that? They just leave them there. The story ends with the resolution of the romance for most of them, but not the resolution of the whole story. Unless it was integral to the story, like Christmas Inheritance, where, like, you know, part of the story was, are you going to accept your inheritance or this place that you've been given? There's another one, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's about a gift company, and she goes back to the town undercover to determine whether or not she can love the people of this town, and it was so that she could take over the company. And the assumption is she's not going to live in that town. She's going to go back to New York and take over the company. And the man realizes that, too. I mean, so I think they leave a lot of that hanging. And you just have to decide in your own mind, how do I want this to end?
I suppose that's true.
Whereas, if you think about it, like with the Christmas Prince, and I know that is not everybody on this call's favorite.
I love that one.
Mine either. But the thing is they continue it, like, at least from a series perspective of where they're the demonstration of she has the prince and the title, but keeps like her blog and keeps her voice. So there is this in the second one, the royal engagement. There is this, you know, not overly well done, but believable conflict between the expectations of her as a future queen and the attempt to stifle who she is in her voice. So it actually, the identity theme starts to build out more in those where they're trying to show, here's, she got all the princess stuff, but she got to keep, you know, or she's striving to keep the modern, the blog, the followers, the voice that she has, the investigative journalism. So those kind of continue with, there's that resolution, but also continuation of how does she manage those worlds actually colliding as opposed to a one or the other.
But you see, now you said something there very interesting. That's true. I think that's absolutely true. It's not Hallmark. The Netflix ones are different than the Hallmark ones.
Agreed.
I'm not saying that some are better than others. Obviously some are better than others, but I'm not saying that one is better than the others, but they are different. The Netflix ones, I don't think I saw more than one glass of wine in any of the Hallmark ones. They're always sipping cocoa. But, you know, in 12 12 Dates of Christmas, which is not Hallmark, I think it's actually Disney, they meet in a bar. There's much more representation in the Netflix film, whether it be gender representation or ethnic representation within the films, I've noticed. So it makes sense to me that the Netflix films would continue that, even though they still are playing within the genre. The Netflix ones, like, even are more a little more suggestive. Like, they're the one, what's the one with, oh, she's an heiress. Dear Santa. Yeah. In Dear Santa, she's talking to the, again, never stated but assumed gay best friend chef. And he makes a reference saying, you guys plowed snow together. That's one step away from plowing together. And I'm like, yeah. I've never heard that. Even that, obviously, PG level of suggestion, it's not in a Hallmark movie. Hallmark doesn't seem as interested in those murky questions. So, I mean, like, you're talking about their Christmas prince. That actually makes sense to me, because I think Netflix has a better sense in some ways of maintaining that. Like, most of the ones I saw with, again, Candace Cameron Bure, she's a doctor or she's a writer, and she finds home in the Christmas town, gives up her career, lands there. And I told you about Charming Christmas. They're going to make the big sale, which would take them global. And now, she stayed where she was, in a sense, although the guy's probably Santa, so maybe she moves to the North Pole, who knows. But she gives up on the big sale to stay small. You know what I mean? So, whereas you're right about Christmas Prince, where she keeps her voice, she sort of finds her voice, while at the same time having both worlds. Because you're right, they are long-distance dating in that next movie. But the other ones, I didn't get that sense. It's felt more all or nothing to me. I don't know.
So I think that's where one of my other observations comes in, is what I determined was a good versus a bad film was how willing I was to suspend my belief of reality. Right? So
they were all bad? Is that what you're saying?
Here's something that
Exhibit A, Spirit of Christmas.
So whenever I would go to Disney World, I was always surprised at how people will just suspend their belief in reality. And when these dressed up human beings come out in costumes, they will scream with delight that adults, that Mickey Mouse is here or that Donald is here, and like want to get their picture taken with these human beings in costumes. And there's just willingness to suspend your belief that you really are talking to Mary Poppins and that Alice in Wonderland just walked past you, and you know that you're willing to, you want to. And so a good holiday movie, one of these holiday romance movies, has to get you to the point where you're willing to suspend your belief to experience the movie. And so you keep picking up Charming Christmas, you weren't willing to believe that he was really Santa, and it ruined the movie for you, because you weren't willing to suspend your belief. But Spirit of Christmas, somehow, at least Heather and I were able to be like, yeah, there's a ghost, we're good with it. Sure, he comes back every year and he talks to her and he's real. Sure, we'll go with that. And we were willing to suspend our belief for the sake of the story. And so I think even with like people giving it all up or ending the movie before you really know what happens, is that willingness. Are you willing to suspend your belief to let the romance happen, to hear the story out?
Which, you know, and to that point is, you know, being willing to do it in other forms of movies. Like, we're willing to do it with Marvel. We're willing to do it with, you know, that, you know, a human, somebody, a right, you know, Iron Man and Thor, you know, and, you know, when you think about DC and like Wonder Woman and Aquaman, we're willing to suspend that belief that these films can happen and we're engaged. So what is, you know, why would we not do it with these as well? You know, why do we adjust our expectation as to what's believable to make a good movie or an entertaining one, but yet in like the Hallmark realm where it's just average people living average, you know, well, mostly average lives. Some of it's, you know, obviously if you've got ghosts coming back, it's a little far-fetched, but they're more relatable and more, you know, kind of applicable to our context. And that's harder for us to swallow than Thanos is going to snap his fingers. So what's the difference in that? Like, I'm really curious, especially, you know, to Steve, knowing that all of our Screenfish conversations as we get going on Star Wars and Marvel and all of these like big epic series, we're willing to buy into that every single time it comes out. But if it's something that is more human and relatable and day-to-day and almost average life, it's why is it harder to believe or to appreciate or to be engaged with, you know, or is it just, you know, something within ourselves?
What are you talking about? Is it from genre to genre? Like, are you saying?
Well, yeah. So why would, like, if you think about the Hallmark Christmas movie genre,
yeah,
the people are pretty average. Yes, they all look the same and the plot is the same, but, you know, they're in small towns versus big town America. And that, you know, we're like, would this ever happen? Or why does she leave her job? Or can a ghost really come back? And would you really get snowed in? And we're critical of it. And I say we, like, in a general context, not saying everybody or any.
Right. I hear what you're saying.
But we're not necessarily that critical to where we're not willing to suspend our belief in something like Marvel movies or in Star Wars. So what makes it about genre that you know, I guess, challenges us to buy into it or not?
Well, first of all, I'm appalled at the thought that Star Wars isn't a documentary. It happened a long time ago in a galaxy far away.
That is real. Just like Lord of the Rings. I mean, that happened. Middle Earth was around a long time
ago. Yeah, so, I mean, let's put that aside for now.
Okay.
But
all right. We'll come back to that one.
We'll come back. But it's an interesting question. I never thought of it that way. To me, it's like I didn't have a problem suspending my disbelief, ironically, with things like he may be Santa. That didn't bother me. That was in like four of the movies I saw. And it wasn't always the old lovable man who was in town. It was like, you know, the hot, sexy lead guy was Santa. And I was like, yo, I never
like
got my picture with
marrying
him.
Marrying Father Christmas movies.
Yeah.
Finding Father Christmas, engaging Father Christmas, marrying Father Christmas.
Yeah. Like this, like, in all honesty, I didn't have a problem suspending my belief, my disbelief. In that one, you know, I allowed myself to enjoy them on the level that they were. But to me, it's all about connection. What not necessarily the type of the actor or the actress, but in some way, how do you connect with the film? So there's something about Star Wars or Marvel that connect with a certain subset of the public in a way that other films do not. And sometimes it's about special effects and all that stuff, and I get that's what it is. But by now, we're all so invested in the Marvel train, those who are watching it. Like, it's not just about, ooh, they did that. Like, you're more in, like, people are sad when characters die, you know? And so to me, it's about what do you connect with as opposed to suspending my disbelief. These films, like I said before, to bring me in, because they're so cookie-cutter, there has to be something about them that I connect with. And I think that's, in a lot of times, it's the charisma of the characters. That's what draws me in. I'm willing to suspend my disbelief on the stupidity of the story and enjoy it for what it is, because they're all ridiculous. I don't think there's any of them that I saw that I would say that could happen, like, personally. like, you have to suspend your disbelief to hit play. But there are certain aspects.
That's brutal, Steve.
It's true.
Low blow.
But I don't think that's a problem, because you're right. We suspend our disbelief on just about anything. I love Jane the Virgin. We've been binge-watching Jane the Virgin for the first time, my wife and I, and they mock the telenovela structure as they're doing it, but you're still invested in it. And when things happen, you still go, oh no, how are they going to deal with it now? And that's really the key thing I got out of my soap opera study back all those days, is that it's not so much about the event that happens, it's how those characters deal with it in the future.
You mean they can't die and come back alive three different times?
That's why they come back.
Come back and always come back being younger? Like, wait, that's not possible?
No. They always bring... Oh, please, what do you... Oh, they always bring back the same actor. Jeez.
I know.
They age, like, the children in Fast Forward. That's... they never... but, like, in all seriousness, the action that happens can be ridiculous. But they keep bringing people back from the dead because, oh my gosh, how does that affect the person I already care about? That's why they do it. And that's, you know, with so much of these films, I think that's what keeps – that's why they can get away with madness. because they want it to be so character-based. The writing's ridiculous, but... I don't know. That's what I would think. I don't know what you ladies think.
Well, I think what you hit on was my last, like, big thing that I came in with after all the movies is, look, man, there's got to be some kind of spark between the two main characters. Hmm. Like, I'm talking about being willing to suspend your belief. So I can totally buy that the innkeeper is actually Santa and Mrs. Claus. But if the characters aren't having some kind of connection where I'm thinking, oh, I want to see him kiss, or oh, I want to see him get together, or whatever. If that's not happening, if I'm just like, gosh, yawn worthy, you are boring as all get out. I don't care if you ever get together. I'm not going to watch the movie. I mean, it's not going to draw me into the story. Like, to me, all of those things have to be there. It's got to be about Christmas for it to be a truly, quote unquote, Hallmark Christmas movie. It's got to have a spark between the two main characters, and there has to be a willingness for me to suspend my belief and accept the plot as it is. And if those aren't there, I'm probably going to turn it off halfway through, because let's just face it, I've already watched it.
I was just listening to what Christina said and how she kind of just really summarized this whole formula to it. You know, and in her case, there's three requirements. And so, Christina, if, like, one of them is missing, would you still keep watching it? Or does it have to have all three? Yep. So you've got, like, a three criteria. Whereas I think for me, first off, my criteria for starting this is we were planning this podcast. So that was my but now that I've watched a few of them, you know, I think it's true for these. It's true for absolutely any movie or any series, is, yes, chemistry between characters through the entire cast, not even just your main characters, but chemistry that these people really are doing life together, whether they are superheroes or whether they're running in Midway, Utah or somewhere, that there has to be this, there does have to be believability that this is an actual community going through these experiences. If I felt that, I was pretty much like, okay, these people really could be doing this somewhere, even in another dimension. Like, I don't know. But this feels like a community to me, so I might as well see what happens. I am a little bit vain. I love a good-looking, like, guy. Like, I'm not going to deny that. So, I know it's totally vain and, like, shallow, but that's, you know, why some of these movies can be a little vain and shallow. So I'll play into that stereotype for a minute. Well, and I think that was pretty much it. I mean, I didn't like if it was a lame, fall flat ending. Like, I really enjoyed The Night Before Christmas. First off, I love Vanessa Hudgens. I loved High School Musical and everything, and I thought she did a really good job. The ending of that was so flat and so non-climactic or anticlimactic, however you want to say it. It was just, like, boring. And I'm like, you built me up this whole time, and the ending was just lame. So that could ruin the entire movie if the ending was lame. Yeah. Not even believable. If it just was flat. If it was just lame. I was like, that was a waste of 2 hours. Like, that's fair. I sat through all those commercials and that's the ending I get? Like, really? Yeah, no.
I want to be sensitive to time, so I want to get to the question that we said about what it is about Christmas that's so central, because I know we've talked about that. Before we do that, I just want to draw one point, and it almost ruined my entire experience. Of all of these movies, I was so proud of myself, talking about the relationship and the chemistry between the characters. I was so proud of myself. I clocked the awkward almost kiss in every single movie I watched. I did. The earliest...
You're dedicated.
The earliest one was 41 minutes into the film, and the latest one was... Wait a second here. An hour and 11 minutes. There's always that moment where they're about to kiss and then something happens, someone interrupts, until one movie ruined the whole thing, and that was Charming Christmas, which did not have that. I'm talking...
Really?
Yes. All of them had one except Charming Christmas. I was like, does this prove or disprove my theory? Anyway, I was really... Maybe that's why I hated the movie. Pardon?
What about Merry Christmas? I mean, it literally starts with a kiss.
I couldn't watch Merry Christmas. I couldn't get it. I tried to find it. I couldn't find it.
That would have blown you out of the water because, like, literally 5 minutes in, they're kissing. But go ahead.
That's fair.
Yeah, and I don't think the Mistletoe Secret that aired last night on Hallmark, I don't think there was a really awkward kissing that one, and they were drinking martinis. So that was a Hallmark where they were drinking martinis.
Wow. Well, there goes all my research. All of it's done. It's blown out of the water.
your whole world is blown out of the water, Steve.
Life makes no sense.
Completely, like, invalidated with all of it. Sorry, go rewrite your thesis.
That's right. Oh, man. Let's wrap up with this. I know you ladies are on time constraints. So what is it about Christmas that's so central to making these movies as popular as they are?
Well, I think all of us have this, like, not all of us, maybe. But maybe we do. Maybe it is all of us that kind of have this hope and wish and dream that Christmas can be all that we're promised it's going to be. We want to have all these, like, amazing experiences, and we want to have that feel-good Christmas with our family, and we want to pretend for at least one day that all of our problems aren't real, or that our family does get along and that we are together. It's there. We almost, like, try to force it to happen, I think. And we inundate ourselves with the kinds of things that make us feel that way. And I mean, I know we're talking about the holiday romance movies and those in particular, but I mean, if you look at almost any Christmas movie, you get this, like, there is good in this world. There is peace in this world. There is something special. And for one day, we're just going to embrace it, and we're going to all buy into this and really believe in, I guess, what we could call the Christmas spirit. And I think that's where I'm coming from with, if that's not central to the plot, to me, it fails as a Hallmark Christmas movie, because it's missing the whole point of giving us that feel good thing where at the end of the movie you go, see, I knew there could be good. I knew that these people could get together. I knew with everything stacked against them that good would come out. Because we want to believe that for us and for our families and for Christmas Day. And I think that's where the popularity comes in, because the reality of the situation is it's not all that. Our lives are not that. And I think we want it. And so I think that these Christmas movies really pull us to that. And they put every single Christmassy thing that could be tied to nostalgia in it, from cookies and cocoa to live Christmas trees and, you know, community parties and you name it. They put it in there, anything that could spark something in someone to go, oh, I loved that growing up, or, oh, I've always dreamed about having a Christmas like that. And I really think that it pulls to it. And if it's not there, it's kind of where it falls flat. And if it is there, yeah, that's when you can forgive some bad acting.
It kind of comes down to hope and holding on to this hope when there is absolutely no reason, but when it doesn't seem obvious that we should be hopeful. I mean, especially, you know, in the Christian church, and as you go through a liturgical calendar of preparation and peace and joy and hope, it's this, it might be corny, but at the end of the day, we all want good to happen. We want the dreams to come true. We want the impossible to be possible. You know, we hold on to that childlike faith. We want Santa to be real. We want magical Christmas Eves with snow falling. You know, we want cookies to bring the world together. We want those things, whether we admit it or not. There's that Christmas-sized hole, I think, in all of us. And that's why these types of films resonate, even if we don't understand it, because there's this underlying element that Christmas does make everything possible.
Yeah, and that's something that's a recurring theme. It was funny, you know, from the notes I took, if a film didn't have the word faith, it had the word hope, or it had the word love. And I'm not trying to over-spiritualize that in any sense, but yeah, there was faith, hope, and love in every film that I saw, and the greatest of those was love. Now I'm just over-spiritualizing it. But I see what you're both saying. And, I think that's where the depth and the appeal of the films truly lies. Because you're right. There's something there that wants to drive us all to believe in good. Now, people are looking for different things in their films now. They're looking for more representation and those sorts of things. And that's changed some of those questions. But at the heart of each one of these films, regardless of that, the challenge is for us to be not wrapped up so much in things like money or ourselves and look to others. I appreciated the fact that some of them tried to push it when they talked about things like serving the homeless or adoption, those two that I saw, two or three that I saw that were involved in those sorts of conversations, because it wasn't just about finding romance. There was some sort of giving to others that sort of extended beyond that identity question, and I appreciated that. But again, it still stems to that belief that, you know, we want good to happen, and a lot of times, how can we help do that for others as well as ourselves? So I appreciated that as well. The idea of family was key, home is key, which I think is an interesting one to be as a main theme. Because for a lot of people, family and home is not that safe space that they float in the movies. Yet that is sort of the standard here. But maybe it's because for some of those people, they're still looking for that. It connects. So it's not just, oh, don't worry, home is fine. It's also finding a new home, which meets those qualifications, of believing that there is good in the world. And that it applies to everyone, I think, is so key. To me, it's interesting because as a pastor, you know, Christmas certainly has that Christian origin to it, which isn't very present in these films. And I'm not saying that as a criticism, but I'm saying what it is Christmas is now much more of an idea, of a standard. Which I'm okay with. I'm okay with in this context. It absolutely should be, because it's trying to remind us about that belief in looking for what is good. That would be my take. But I certainly see what you're saying.
It is kind of figuring out, you know, whether you're a 21st century woman or, you know, man or whomever, you're still looking for good. You're still looking for hope. You know, you still want love and family, whatever that means for your context. So it's still a universal kind of theme. And I think that is what makes it, you know, it's almost like a timeless appeal.
Well, you threw
it. I think the identity thing, too, has a lot to do with the 21st century woman. Because a lot of what I read is a lot of, you know, we've been told we can have it all. The modern woman can be the full-time mom and the full-time worker and the career woman, and she can breastfeed and do formula and, you know, like all of it. And I think identity is a big issue for 21st century women. So whether or not the movies do that great of a job addressing it, I think it just hits on, yeah, I've asked myself that, or yeah, I've wondered about that myself type thing.
Yeah.
So implicit, it's implicitly there, almost.
The one question I would love to ask you guys, and I think would be great on a podcast, is what was your favorite holiday food that was cooked in these things? Because, oh my gosh, you guys, like you didn't have a good movie unless it had, like, a token something delicious. And I'm going with the cherry chip loaf from 12 Days of Christmas. I don't know what that thing is, but I want to taste it one day. Oh my gosh, there were so many.
There is a big difference between cookies and pie. Like, those are indeed not the same category. Yes, they both use an oven, and they might have some similar ingredients, but you're sitting down to eat a pie at a diner versus pulling cookies out of an oven, you're having two totally different experiences.
Well, I mean, I know Christmastown, whatever it was in Christmastown, the woman that ran that bakery, everybody came in and kept asking for cookies, so I don't know what ingredient she was putting in there. it might have been special gingerbread cookies, I don't know, but everybody kept asking for them. I'm like, what, why are they so different?
And whatever he cooked in 12 Dates or in Dear Santa, the chef for the party.
Oh yeah,
I'm like, I want to go to that party.
What in the heck did he cook? She called him at the last minute, and he showed up with this gourmet food.
They go back and they make all these hors d'oeuvres in like 2 seconds, and then go out and rev up the party.
I tell you.
Know, whereas the spirit of Christmas had a whole like 1920s, 30s rum runner bar, so yes. I mean, that kind of replaced some of the cookie and the baked good aspect. There was actually like adult beverages, which I thought was hilarious because they're like, instead of cookies, we're talking about mixed drinks that were, you know, run through the border.
What was that?
Of Canada and the U.S. So there you go.
That's right. That's right. And 12 dates, doesn't he try to order her a lager and she,
a beer?
Yeah.
She doesn't like it.
But then at the end she does. Because she's had it enough times.
Nice, because she's willing to try
new things. There it is.
She's discovered that her identity is not based on what drink she picks.
Oh, come on. Okay, Christina, you're pushing it now. You had me until the booze, all right? Once you start...
Oh. We just had to put it out. We had to throw off your other theory. We had to throw off your other theory. We're just here to like mess up all of Steve's theories.
That's it. Because I am a man, I just don't understand. That's it.
You know that's not true, Steve.
No, I'm too invested in soap operas. That's why. But
and the funny thing is that I watched most of these with someone, like my daughter or my mother-in-law or my sister-in-law. And their reactions, too, were hilarious. But Naomi, in particular, she's my middle daughter. She loves Spirit of Christmas and who she calls the hot ghost. So she's like, he can haunt my house any day. I'm like, you're 13.
Can I just say...
Naomi is, like, my spirit animal. Like, that girl.
Having said that, ladies, we should screen it or skip it. Hallmark Christmas movies, screen them or skip them?
You got to screen at least a couple. Like, if you have to choose, you know, at least give 12 Dates of Christmas a try. At least give Spirit of Christmas a try. So I would at least screen a couple. Maybe not all.
I'd say I screen it. But, you know, if it ain't happening for you, you can stop at halfway and try another one.
If you don't like one, try another. Like those special Christmas cookies. Just keep going. Eventually your mind will achieve a state of zen where
you'll just stumble upon gold.
Zen, boredom.
That's the one I was looking for.
They're so ridiculous. I can't say in good conscience screen it, but in reality, you already know if you're going to like it or not before you watch it. So you might as well, yeah. Skip them.
Ouch.
I don't even like 12. I will say this. 12 Dates of Christmas was, and I use the term lightly, the smartest of all of them. Because I didn't clue in until my wife actually clued in on like the ninth day. That each day had all the representation of every other day in some different way or another. Yes. I didn't clue in. So, like she said, I have to go back and watch that again. And I'm like a big Mark Paul Gosselaar fan. I grew up with Zach Morris. But I just didn't think it was that enjoyable. I thought it was okay.
We watch it every year. We walk around all year long saying, I spritzed you and you passed out.
I do like The Christmas Prince. And I liked Night Before Christmas way more than I thought I would. Both Netflix ones. I mean, the scene where the guy drives the car to me in Night Before Christmas is hilarious because he has no idea what to do and he just leaves
it on the street. It was pretty funny.
I thought that was pretty creative. Or when he's trying to talk to Alexa. I'm like, that's good stuff.
When he starts to impart, like, you know, slang with his 12th century knight language or something. And he goes into this, like, generic, like, Midwest generic. You know, accent or something. That was fantastic.
How do you differentiate the term bay? And I was like, all right, that got me. I like that one. But ladies, thank you so much. This has been so much fun getting into this with you both. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. That was awesome.
Yeah, it was fun. And for you at home, a reminder that you can find us anywhere the podcasts are available. On Spotify, iTunes Podcasts, or Apple Podcasts, on Google Play, Podomatic, SoundCloud, and you can find us on your Alexa device via Stitcher. And if you go to the podcast page at screenfish.net, you can download Fishing for More, so that you can try and dialogue with the Hallmark Christmas films or Christmas films in general as you watch them with your family and friends this season. And we will be back next week for our last episode of the year, which is oddly appropriate. It's also the last week of the year, but we're going to take a break after that because we have to cover Star Wars Rise of Skywalker before the year runs out. Usually I'd like to end with the Christmas episode, but we will do that one in addition. But ladies, thank you again so much. This has been so much fun getting into this with you. And for you at home, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.